when we are trying to educate executives, we need to start trying to help them get their heads around that. Number one, this is a fast-paced, moving and evolving environment with many moving parts. And yes, you will be breached at some point, but what will absolutely differ is the size, scale, and the consequence of that breach.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Joining me today is Mark Anderson, National Security Officer from Microsoft Australia and New Zealand. And today, we're discussing the reality of the cybersecurity threats that exist for Australian businesses. So Mark, thanks for joining and welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So I really want to get into things, and I'm really curious to hear your thoughts. I've seen your background. You've got quite a long tenure at Microsoft, and I really want to get your thoughts on, we're seeing both an increase in the number of breaches, a 26% increase, in fact, in the second half of 2022 in Australia, which was reported from the OAIC, but also the cost of a breach is increasing. So what is happening in security globally and in Australia that is driving this? And then I guess subsequently, what do we need to do to consider when we talk about the cost or an impact of a data breach?
Yeah, sure. So I think, first of all, when we think about the global cost of cybercrime, so third-party estimates put that at around $6 trillion US dollars this year, with a view that by 2025, we'll be hitting around $10 trillion US dollars. And unfortunately, with like all of these very forward-looking, very depressing estimates, we're normally wrong by the time we actually get to that actual year of prediction. But also, just to put those numbers in a little bit of context, earlier on, I was just checking what was the total GDP for Australia. And back in 2021, that was set at 1.5 trillion. So if you think about it, this year, that 6 trillion figure is effectively four times in Australia in terms of the amount of money that will be lost to global cybercrime. By the time we get to that 2025 point, we'll be at 6.5 plus times. So it's quite scary when you think about the amount of cost globally from a cybercrime perspective. But for me, I think there's three things that are ultimately driving this increase and driving an increase in cybercrime activity. And the first one, and probably the most forefront one of mind for me, is that commercialization and commoditization of cybercrime. So this is where we're seeing cybercrime or cybercriminal syndicates, should I say, actually taking their tools and capability and offering them out as a service. So you can either buy or rent that capability from that cybercrime gang. So what does this mean ultimately for us? Well, it means that if you have an organization where, let's say you want to get into that ransomware business, but you're no good at gaining access to the environment initially, but you're really good at the extortion part of the ransomware game, then you can just outsource that initial access to somebody else. And all of the elements of that cybercrime process are now something that you can buy as a service, as I say, from initial entry point to all the way through to cryptocurrency money laundering services. So that's the first big one. The second one for me is the increase in what we call human-operated ransomware. So the way to think about human-operated ransomware is, if you think about what I'll call traditional ransomware, if you like, or version one ransomware, where we would send out tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of emails, and whoever clicks on the link or opens the document or whatever it is, which is the delivery mechanism for the actual malicious payload, whoever clicks or opens it next is the victim. And then for a relatively modest amount of money or Bitcoin, you could receive the key to unlock your environment. In the human-operated ransomware gang's world, what they're doing is before targeting it, or as they target an environment, instead of just trying to say, oh, we will target company X and send them a bunch of emails, what we will do is they'll actually spend their time researching that organization, understanding really effectively what they can pay, so that by the time that they actually successfully manage to execute their campaign, you tend to find that the ransoms are an order of magnitude higher than they would be if it was just a random send out and whoever clicks next type environment. And then the third one for me is business email compromise. So business email compromise, this is where you'll find cyber criminals injecting themselves into business process, if you like. So watching the way, gaining access to email systems, then watching the way that people within that organization communicate, maybe from a point of view of Bob sends Jane an invoice and then Jane pays the invoice. Well, they would watch the way that Bob and Jane communicate. And then at some point, the attacker will pretend to be Bob and change the bank account details or the destination details. And the difference between that and ransomware tends to be that BEC operates in a very stealthy way. So in a lot of times, when these actual attacks are taking place, they're not always immediately discovered, whereas something like ransomware is a very noisy and very public display, if you like. And all of these three things for me are the main drivers at the moment. And I think it's really important to also recognize that all three of these are not just big enterprise issues. They affect everyone from small businesses through to enterprise. And then I can give you an interesting example of this. It was probably about 2 years ago now, a friend of mine who owns a small real estate business. Their environment was breached by an attacker. This is a business email compromise approach. They watched the way in which he and his assistant would talk to each other about moving things like housing deposits around, and then eventually interjected themselves into the process. And as a result, they ended up moving $60,000 to an account where they were unable to recover that money. And the only reason this actual criminal got caught was because they were greedy and they came back again. So whilst this process was something that these two individuals did quite regularly, they came back, asked to do it again. And it only just so happens that he happened to be walking past her desk at the time. And she said, I'm pretty sure I've already done this for you. And he goes, I have no idea what you're talking about. So they actually caught them. So again, it's about all sizes of business, whether it's small or large. But coming back to your point of around how do we know what it, in terms of cost, what is the cost of an actual impact? I think what we've got quite good at this point is able to calculate what the cost is in terms of IT recovery, maybe even to the point where we can make estimates around what would compensation payments look like. Like one of the organizations recently obviously was tasked with paying for replacing people's passports. However, for me, I think the true cost is unknown, and I don't think we're going to know for some time, because it's the intangible costs, which I think are the ones we're not really quite sure how to calculate yet. Things like the cost of to brand, cost to sales, cost to customer base, and ultimately customer trust, which is really something that's not easily calculated. So we're not really going to see the effects of that for some time, because when would a customer choose a competitor brand because of the fact that they didn't like the way you handled the incident? Not really going to know that. Maybe at the next time they have a renewal, or so you see it in customer churn, but I don't think we're going to know the true cost of an impact of a data breach for a couple of years after the event.
Great point. So a couple of things I want to get into a little bit more. And you raise a really good point then just at the end around the intangible costs. And this is something that I think about as well. So there was a company last year in Australia. If you actually looked at their stock that week, it plummeted significantly because of the breach. And then to your point, Mark, around, well, we're not going to really know, because now as we traverse moving forward, people are going to say, oh, well, you were the company that got breached. Therefore, they are going to start losing, well, potentially losing that footprint. And then it's more so the long time of people, maybe until the dust settles, that they come around to it or how they handle it. But then also, we're just never going to fully know until, you know, reporting time comes up that, well, actually, we're not, you know, doing any more customer acquisitions. We're not getting new customers. And it's probably linked to the breach, of course, but it's going to be hard to tell initially. How do you think that you can convey that to executives to be like, look, we really don't know, but it's the long-term impact and the longevity of that brand or of trying to get new customers post-breach, for example?
Yeah, like you say, I don't think anybody's got a great answer to it right now. I think all you can convey at that executive level is the initial impact and what it could actually mean to your organization. Because you think about a cyber incident, whilst you may come out the other side of it, like those ones that, you know, we've seen over the past couple of years, they are still continuing to operate as a business. But there are scenarios where you could end up being cyber attacked such that you come out the other side of it and you do not have a business because the impact is so great. So I think it's a really difficult one to try and put a value on that, apart from sort of saying there is a sliding scale of risk and it ranges from this end of nothing happening through to having no business. And it's a really difficult one for me. And I'm not quite sure exactly how we articulate that or how we track that over time. But I think it's just something that people need to be absolutely aware of and understand what consequence looks like.
Yeah, and you're right. There's no easy answer to any of these things, and there's no like right or wrong answer. It's just more so having a discussion just to get people like yourself and have your thoughts injected into the conversation. But then I sort of want to maybe explore this a little bit more, and I do many podcast interviews, people like yourself all over the world, different companies, et cetera, and we're talking about the threats that are out there. But then maybe from your point of view, Mark, do you think executives – really understand what's going on? I mean, when I say executives, I don't mean like CISO, et cetera. I think they do, well, they should do. More if you broaden it out and you zoom out, your CEO, CFO and friends, because I think people say they do, but then again, I'm always about the action then behind that.
Yeah, and I'd say if you asked me this question 3 years ago, then we'd absolutely have a very different answer in it. Just be straightforward and I'd just say no and we'd move on, because nobody did have a – I don't think anybody outside of that cyber or IT realm actually truly understood or appreciated it. But I'd say that the first time for me that these types of questions that were coming through from outside of the CISO or outside of the CSO realm really started in the COVID times. And this is because of the rapid implementation of things like remote work. So when remote work kicked in, there was this desire to understand the risks that were associated with remote work and IT systems, especially for organizations that weren't very forward on allowing employees to work from home. So that's when, from my perspective, my diary started to fill up with people asking me to come in and talk to exec teams. But I'd say the real influx of inquiry was actually after the breaches that we saw last September and October. And after that, there was a hell of a lot more urgency when it came to discussing cyber, and cyber then tended to be on the table at every single leadership and board meeting. And if you think about it, the one thing that really pushed them was because these are the executives that don't really read the trade press. They're not following the trade journals or the trade podcasts. They're opening things like The Australian, they're opening the AFR, they're opening the Financial Times and all of these types of publications, or they're watching the mainstream news. And all of a sudden, they're seeing these organizations getting a lot of press attention, and not great press attention, getting a lot of press attention, both on print, online, and all sorts of other forms of media, such as also being smashed on social, and then also having the pressure of government ministers coming out and making comment on the actual incident and how it's being handled. So all of a sudden, you started to see that these exec teams and these boards were starting to take notice, because they now wanted to understand what was going on. So my diary started to fill up pretty rapidly, being called in to talk to these boards and talk to the exec teams about what the threat landscape looks like and how real it actually was and what would it actually mean to them. And sometimes it was that non-IT executives that would reach out. We'd have the CFO or whoever reach out. But in a lot of cases, it was the CISO actually saying, can you come in and help me? I just need an external validation, if you like, of the points that they've been trying to make to their own internal teams. And then just interestingly, when I started to do these, what I found really interesting was the types of questions that would come out of these teams. And they were at the extremes. I mean, I remember going into one of these sessions and I remember getting asked a question about quantum and whether quantum was something that they needed to worry about and whether all of a sudden quantum was going to become a problem and they were going to have all of their encryption broken, which I thought, you know, good on you for thinking way ahead into the future, but you've probably got some other issues you need to be solving in the meantime. But I'd say one of the really interesting tells that was on one of the questions that I had, and that was along the lines of they turned around to me and just basically said, just tell me how much I need to spend to make this problem go away, which was a moment where I thought, hang on, how do I answer that? I'll get to what I said in a moment, but it was one of those, oh, I know why you're asking this. And it's because cyber has always just been thought of as a cost of IT, it's part of IT. And for most executives, their exposure to IT and spend on IT is normally, if they get called in, it's because it's some form of big capital expenditure. Like, we're in the manufacturing industry and we want to put a new ERP system in. So it's going to cost $60 million. It's going to take 3 years. And at the end of those 3 years, we have a nice new manufacturing system that will enable us to be more efficient and make more money. So for them, it's quite straightforward. They know it's 3 years. They know it costs $60 million and they know they're getting something out the other end of it. They couldn't get their head around that cyber was this thing that you can't just spend money on and away you go. It is a constant investment. And the answer that I did give at that point, which was completely off the cuff, was
I think you spend up until the point where your appetite for spending meets your risk appetite for your organization. And that was the off-the-cuff answer that I gave at that moment in time. But it did also make the point to them that, you know, money isn't always the answer either. You know, take something like the US Department of Defense. They have eye-watering budgets, but are they completely cyber secure? No, they're not. Yes, money will help you buy better tools, get more people, et cetera, but it's not always the answer. Now, one thing that I've just come back from, actually, 2 weeks ago, I just came back from a trip to our mothership in the US over in Seattle. And the reason why I was there is that we actually just took over 31 CISOs and senior leaders from across Australia and New Zealand, across both commercial and government. We headed out there to do a week of what's the future of cyber, what are the trends and so forth that we're seeing. Not a product week, just more of a trends and futures, which whilst the content was great, for me, what I found really interesting is when you got all these CISOs in the room together and just listening to the conversations about the problems that they were having within their own organizations and how some had done managed to do a really good job of getting their senior leadership and board on board with understanding cyber and understanding the risks and therefore putting the investment in. But some of the others were still struggling. Going back to my point a moment ago is that they still thought of it like an IT style overhead and not thinking about it in the way you would traditionally think of risks. But one of the really interesting sessions that we had whilst we were there, we did a startup speed dating, if you like. We had 10 startups that all had 10 minutes each to talk to these CISOs on what was coming out and coming down the line. And one of those startups was a company called Cova. And one of the attendees at the event actually was a customer of Cova. And the, what Cova actually does in this scenario is they've built a risk quantification tool where you put in all of your organizational details, your financial details, et cetera, and you're able to start modeling risk against a monetary value. And for that particular CISO, that is exactly the language that their board and senior leadership needed to speak. So through this tool, he was able to model the risk and put a financial cost against it and then able to put that in front of the senior leaders. So again, there are different organizations need different ways of explaining it to that leadership level. But, you know, to go back to that point, like if he would have been 3 years ago, we'd have absolutely been a no. But over the last 18 months or so, that mindset has most definitely shifted.
Great insight and great observation as well. I would agree. One of the things which was interesting that you mentioned is because of the breaches. So would you say, Mark, that we had to have one of these breaches to this catastrophic level occur for maybe to have people start paying attention? Now, I know it sounds bad, but maybe, yes, people, companies suffered, et cetera. Then maybe this is going to be the impetus for other people in the future to not suffer or not suffer as much because now there is that awareness and people are saying, well, how much money do I need to spend to get this problem solved? Would you say that, yes, it's horrible that this happened, but then I always like to look on the bright side of life that, well, now the conversations are changing.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And a bit like yourself, I'm always trying to work out how do I put this in a positive way with that. Trying to keep a mind on, you know, what actually the horrible aspect of the event itself. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Because even though these events and high profile events have been happening for years, most of them, when you see them in the news, you know, it might be someone like Marriott Hotels as an example, but it's a big American company, or it will be another organization that's overseas. We never really truly felt that impact at home. And I think that is the real turning point. Because all of a sudden it felt real and it felt personal, and not just felt real and felt personal at a organizational business perspective, but actually just your regular person on the street. When all of a sudden the regular person on the street is all of a sudden worried about the fact that their driver's license or their passport or their personal medical details have been leaked out onto the internet for all to see. That really hit home and really hit home hard. So for, yeah, like you say, it, you know, terrible, terrible events, but actually it was probably that catalyst that we actually needed to get people really paying attention to the point where they are today. I mean, you know, since when have we started to see cyber dominate the headlines as much as it has and have government ministers come out and comment on it? You know, it's not happened for a very, very long time. So yes, that is the positive silver lining, if you like, to come out of the past 18 months.
And you also referenced an interesting point and observation around like trade. So obviously I run a trade publication and podcast in cyber. And it's because you're right. big multinationals will say, oh, so-and-so got breached. But then what? They follow the breach and then eventually that dies down. And so what people are saying is, okay, well, now what do we do? What does that mean? And so, you know, I've been doing this podcast for a while, but now I'm doing it a lot more religiously than I was when I started, obviously. But it's more so, well, what does that mean? What does that mean for people? And so that's where I see the show and getting people on it yourself to actually unpack and to make sense of these breaches and to give people, all executives, which is our tagline. It's not just about the CISO. It's about all executives that need to be responsible for this. But again, it was like, okay, well, where do I get the information from? Yeah, these people are telling me these breaches are occurring, but what happens after that point? And that's where I see the show and getting people on like yourself to talk about this is the reality of what's out there. So I really appreciate you sharing your sentiments on that. Now, I want to get to something else, which I think you're going to have a very good view on, is because of social media, it means that people can have a voice and platform and thoughts. But then would you sort of say that executives may be confused because there's so many people out there with difference of opinions? I mean, I interview people a lot and there's very large differences of opinions constantly, it wasn't always a bad thing, but I'm also doing this every single day. So executives that aren't super involved in cybersecurity may not know who to trust or who they should listen to in the market. So do you have any thoughts on that?
I'd say you probably need to pick your sources accordingly, right? I mean, depends on what you're looking for as particular insight as an executive. So if it is that, what is the global view or even local view of cybercrime and technology trends? What's evolving? Where are these threats coming from? Where are they heading? All that type of great stuff. I'd say then, you know, you'd be picking organizations like going away, talking to the ACSC, or it could be talking to people like myself from a Microsoft perspective. I know you had Sean Duker on from Palo Alto a few weeks ago. Again, he was talking about what Palo Alto see from their perspective. So there's a lot of really great resources out there for that type of information. But while that information is interesting and you absolutely should know it because it helps set the scene as an executive in terms of the threats, for me, what it doesn't do is really help you with the being prepared for an incident and what the potential non-IT ramifications are, which is what most execs really do need to know, because it's not normally the technical challenges which are the difficult ones to deal with. It's the dealing with media, it's dealing with regulators, shareholders and customers, things like, you know, who's on point, is absolute transparency the way forward, should you go early when you don't have all the facts, etc. These are all questions that, you know, you and I can sit here comfortably and hypothesize about all day long, but until you've really lived it, you don't actually know. Like the question of, do you tell people early? You know, well, personally, I'm all for transparency, but that has to be balanced with the stress and panic that you might induce in the general public. So you need to think about these situations, not just from the by the book legal and regulatory perspective, but also the morals and ethics that go with it. So for me, the best people to listen to at this point are those that have actually lived through it. Because the one thing you can be sure of is that even those organizations that thought they had a plan in place, as I heard a brilliant quote the other day, somebody said to me, they said, my dad was in the Navy and he always had his plan printed out because when it was time to enact that plan, at least he gave him something to tear up to take his frustration out on, which I thought was absolutely brilliant because, you know, nothing ever does go to plan. So for me, there's always going to be those elements that catch you out, and it's how you deal with them. What structures do you need in place? And again, going back to that example of that tour, Cybersecurity Innovation Tour I just mentioned to you a moment ago, I heard a lot of these stories between the CISOs at that event, and unfortunately, they're not mine to share or tell. But it was those types of learnings that do make organizations more resilient. And I think just on that point as well is that I think it's important to recognize that this type of learning is not something that organizations need to be thinking of as competitive advantage as well. You know, executives of rival organizations need to be sharing these learnings with each other. And again, at that event a few weeks ago, I saw exactly this at that CISO level. Even CISOs from competing orgs were just sharing war stories, offering advice. It was a real sort of community moment. And even if you don't have access to like peers in the industry, again, there's a lot of great case studies out there where you can start to read about these types of experiences, again, outside of the IT side of it. And the one that springs to mind for me on this one is Norsk Hydro. Most people haven't heard of Norsk Hydro. They're actually one of the world's largest aluminium producers. And about a couple of years ago, they got hit by ransomware and knocked out all of their manufacturing plants across the globe. They knocked back into the IT stone ages. They were all out with pens and paper. But the one thing they got praised for in this was their communication. They talked about what was happening, how the recovery effort was going, how customers should contact them, what to expect. And that transparency earned trust. And you could argue they sort of came out the other side of it better. So for me, when you think about who is it that you should be listening to, absolutely go to folks like myself and the ACSC and others, and we can tell you about the threat landscape and how terrible it is and what we're doing from a technology stance. But really, for that exec level, go and speak to those people that have lived it, because there's no better source of information than coming from those people.
I know Norsk Hydro very well. I think I've done a presentation a few years ago about Norsk Hydro. The actual share price went up post-breach, which is unheard of, which is like wild. Usually it goes down, plummets, because they handled it well. But then going back to the plan thing, like, you're so right. When stress kicks in, things don't go to plan ever. But then, you know, there's everyone saying, like, get a plan, be ready. So, I mean, to that point, yes, you need to have an, you know, IRP. I understand all of that. But then when you're in it, and there was someone I spoke to, I think from Tenable at length about this, and there's no real easy or right way to answer this, but it's more so, well, when you're in that stress, it's all well and good for us coaching from the sidelines to say, oh, well, follow the plan, Mark. But then in reality, when you're in that house burning down and, you know, you can't contact anyone and there's everything just going wrong, like, it's a bit hard to just follow the plan. So would you say that people are just super fixated and almost anal retentive about following the plan, which I get, but then you've got everyone outside saying, oh, well, you should be having an IRP and you should be testing it and you should be doing it. So where do you sort of, what do you sort of think on that?
I sort of sit in between it a little bit. I completely agree, right? You know, when the heat is on, the plan will go out the window, because the one thing you can guarantee is that the adversaries are not going to follow the playbook. We do this, then you do that. That's not going to ever happen that way. So you do need to be agile. But I think that's where it comes down to. It's all right to have a plan, but you've got to also drill these things as well. And I know the ACSC do some great sessions on this. And I remember talking to one of the folks that runs the red team. And when they were talking about when they red team and they're working with the blue team to see how they're responding and how they're working, they won't mix it up, because that blue team got a plan on how they're going to respond. And they'll do things like they'll walk in and they'll see that, you know, oh, maybe Jane seems to be the superstar in this team right now. I tell you what we'll do. Walk in and go, hello, Jane. Unfortunately, you've got a personal emergency. We need to take you out of this session right now. So pluck that main person out of it. So throw a curveball into the situation. Now, how does the team deal with that curveball? So that type of drill, I think, is the only thing that you can do in these scenarios, is just, yes, have a plan, but also practice having that plan modified on the fly unexpectedly, not by a, okay, we're going to do this and we'll write down exactly how we're going to not follow the plan. You need somebody just coming in and being, if you've probably heard of Chaos Monkey, which is that tool that Netflix used to randomly inflict faults on their network to see how resilient it is. You need the equivalent of a Chaos Monkey when you're drilling these types of situations and scenarios. Throw in curveballs all over the place so that you get used to understanding how to deal with ambiguity.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's practical, right? So going back to my career about 12 years ago, I worked for Westfield. And every week we do these toolbox exercises, which, you know, similar to a tabletop exercise. But below me down every week, something would go outside of the plan that you would just never envision in your wildest dreams. At least daily, these things were going down that you had to deal with. But then you just had that adaptability. You understood and that something probably was going to go wrong. But it's also using a bit of common sense, not freaking out then as well. And it's not like we had a plan or we didn't practice it to, you know, step 1, 2 to 10. I think just having that communication and understanding, and also dealing with things aren't going to go to plan. Things aren't going to go how you envision them to go. But I think as well that falling back on having, you know, that capability to be able to deal with things as they come. And that's something that I'm so grateful for. It's really built my resiliency now after, you know, running a startup for almost 6 years has helped. But then also it's got me to really think on my feet. So I don't know whether as well, actually, as you're talking here, Mark, what's coming up in my mind is, maybe people, when you're working in like corporates or head offices, you're sort of removed from day-to-day operations of how people are, for example, which probably could be a really good sort of training ground to dealing with breaches and having that level of resiliency to handle when things are just going to be thrown at you, whether you agree or disagree. You're just going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And like you say, it's probably you being able to deal with that ambiguity has probably put you in a really good, as you say, a really good stead for, you know, running as your own organization and your own company, because you're constantly going to get thrown curveballs. So it almost feels like it's less about having the skill of following plans. It's about, almost feels like a bit of a life skill to a certain degree, to just understand how to deal with ambiguity and how to, like you said, think on your feet. So yeah, I completely agree with that.
So just to press on that a little bit more, yes, people should be implementing an IRP and doing, practicing it. But then would you also say that, Mark, this chaos monkey should just be thrown in there? To be like, okay, we're just going to throw it in and see how you people deal with it.
That for me is, when I heard about, and it was, as I say, a friend of mine at the Australian Cybersecurity Centre told me about how they were using that method in their training. I was like, I absolutely love that. And I think we should be doing that. We do that in a technical IT sense, like, as I say, in the Netflix approach, and it's, you know, it's called now chaos engineering. But how do we do that from a people perspective? And so for me, I'd love the idea of throwing that into when you are drilling, because if you're just drilling as per the plan, or you could go away and read the plan, you don't need to drill it. But if you're doing a drill, then throw the curveballs into the drill 100%.
So there's a statement that gets floated around a lot in the market around, it's no longer a question of if, but when an organization falls prey to an attack. So would you say executives do agree with this statement? And maybe it's yes, considering everything we've spoken about already on this interview, but I'm just curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because some do, but I'd also say it's not their natural position either, because it can be a very uncomfortable statement for execs. Because if you unpack what we just said in that statement, you're basically saying that it doesn't really matter what you do, it's going to happen to you. So cynically, if you're asking for cyber investment and you're going to the CFO, cynically, the CFO could turn around and say, so you're asking for money to protect us against the thing that you say is going to happen to us no matter what we do. That doesn't really make any form of financial sense. So why should I invest? I mean, obviously, that's quite a black and white way of putting it. But, you know, that's what the statement is ultimately saying. But this comes back to when we are trying to educate executives, we need to start trying to help them get their heads around that. Number one, this is a fast paced, moving and evolving environment with many moving parts. And you will be breached at some point. But what will absolutely differ is the size, scale, and the consequence of that breach. And most of those components that we just talked about, scale, size, and consequence, most of those will be predicated on the investments that you've already made to protect your organization in the first place. So if you're investing, the idea is that those three sliders are hopefully down to the left-hand side and not up on the right-hand side. And I think this also leads into that interesting question around like expectations. So take, for example, the role of CISO or CSO. Traditionally, many organizations have been very binary about that job description for CISOs, in that your job as a CISO is to secure the company, don't get breached, and if you get breached, you fail. So taking that, if it's not a case of if, it's a case of when, then your position as CISO is really a ticking time bomb where you can't see the countdown clock. So for me, this is really a good example of where understanding and attitudes need to change, because there is no such thing as absolute security, right? So we know that as cybersecurity professionals. But when there's this expectation of absolute security, it shows a lack of understanding and something that we need to absolutely address. You know, however, I also need to caveat what I just said. You know, if a CISO was negligent, you know, that's to say they didn't do their best given the budget, skills and capacity that they had, or they were derelict in their duties, then that's a different conversation in terms of if you should fire them. But that's no different to really any other role within a company. So ultimately, for me, it's really about expectation setting within the organizational leadership to say that, you know, as a CISO, being able to turn around and say, with these resources and constraints, I'm able to achieve X, and this is the residual risk of Y. And then the rest of the executive team and board can make a decision on, as an organization, are they comfortable with that risk weighting or not? And if they're not, then, you know, they need to continue to invest until that investment appetite meets their risk tolerance.
I've never heard that, derelict in their duty. So I like it though. So you make a great point. As if saying, oh, well, give me the money, CFO, but, you know, probably going to get breached anyway. Do you think people are going around and saying that to their CFOs?
No, I don't think it should be as black and white. I think it again comes back to that whole idea that if you're talking to your CFO and saying, I need money, you've got to come up with a way of articulating what will be the payoff for that. A bit like the conversation I was just saying a moment ago around that startup Cova and how one of the CISOs was using that organization to help them articulate what the financial impact of a particular risk would be to the organization, and therefore they could justify the investment. So for me, you've still got to go to CFO with good business sense. But I guess it is just taking that statement that, and a lot of us, including myself across the industry, we always say it's no longer a question of if, but when. But actually also, as I say, tempering that back to the idea that it is an if, but when. It's going to happen. But again, going back to the idea that the difference is the size, scale, and the consequence. You're probably going to get breached multiple times a week, but it might just be it hits somebody's laptop and, you know, antivirus picks it up and it's dead and away you've gone. But could you call that a breach? But at the same point, that's completely different to having your entire customer database extracted. So size, consequence, and scale is always, for me, the sliders that you need to think about.
Absolutely. And I think also caveating that with like best endeavors, like, yes, we, you know, probably will be breached, but we're going to try our best with the investment you're going to give me, CFO, to ensure that that doesn't happen.
For sure.
So I want to talk through maybe your thoughts on key security trends and considerations that organizations should keep in mind for the next 12 months. Don't expect you to be Nostradamus or have a crystal ball, but keen to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. So there's probably three or four, I think, that probably initially spring to mind. I'd say some of it we've already touched on in terms of the types of breaches that have happened over the past. Actually, I always keep saying 12, 18 months, but then I realize that some of the big ones have only happened in the last like September and October, and it's not even been a year yet. But I think for sure there will be changes in the regulatory landscape. So we've already seen things like, you know, SOCI for critical infrastructure. And with those incidents that we've seen over that past year, you know, personal data being leaked, et cetera, I fully expect that we're going to see data retention, privacy laws, et cetera, all modified. So I think that's where we absolutely need to be watching. You know, interestingly, some of this has already come up in some of those exec briefings that I've been doing where customers are thinking about what data do they need to keep and for how long do they need to keep it, which sounds easy, but understanding what you have and where you have it is absolutely the hard bit. So for me, that's probably the first one. The second one is the fact that we have an ever-increasing number of endpoints, an increasing numbers of attacks and a changing landscape. How do we think about moving security closer to the endpoints themselves? And how do we really get serious about implementing zero trust architectures? Because the one thing that we do know is that when attackers get into organizations, the one thing they do very rapidly is start to laterally move within those environments. So how do we get serious quite quickly about getting to those new types of architecture models? And the third, and obviously you can't have a future looking conversation without mentioning the impact of AI, both from an attacker and a defensive standpoint. From an attacker perspective, you know, are we going to see an increase in sophistication in terms of attacks, be that technical attacks, but probably more likely in the social engineering space where these tools are really good at being creative and convincing. But on the defensive side of the house, you know, how do we get these tools into the hands of people to start augmenting their capability? You know, things like burnout in the industry are really, you know, a top topic at the moment. So how can we help people by removing the noise with tools like AI? And how can we start to augment people's skill sets? So I expect to see a lot more in that space. You probably already see that at Microsoft, we've already talked about things like Security Copilot, which gives your security administrators that additional AI capability to do things like look over large amounts of data, or even say, here's a piece of code, tell me what it's doing, even if you don't understand or you're not an expert in that particular language that the code is written in, so you don't have to wait for somebody else to respond. But then the last one I would say is that whilst we always like to look forward, and I've had this asked a few times as well at various exec meetings where they've gone, what is the next thing, an attack perspective that I need to worry about? Because we always have this tendency to think about what's the next thing that we need to prepare for. But unfortunately, the sort of sad fact of the matter right now is that a lot of the attack techniques that were working 2 years ago and 3 years ago are still working today. So I think we really absolutely need to start bumping up or speeding up our ability to get the basics of cyber hygiene in. One of the things that we published out in our digital defense report last year was that
We showed that from our teams that engage in customer investigations, that 98% of attacks can be prevented with basic cyber hygiene. Now, I always appreciate the fact that when we say basic cyber hygiene, it's not always necessarily depending on the size and scale of the environment and a basic thing to implement. But there are a set of known types of controls that will solve 98% of your issues. And I think it's important that as an industry, we don't get caught up on the catastrophizing around the 2%. I know as an industry, we love to do that. As security professionals, we like to come up with what is the most fanciful way we think we can breach or be breached as an organization. But the sad fact of the matter is that the likelihood of you having 7 0-days strung together, put on a USB key and delivered by somebody on a rope through a window and plugged into the back of your computer is way lower than somebody just sending you an email and you clicking the link. So, you know, we've got to drag it back to reality a little bit.
Yeah, I love that. I'm yet to see a rope, but I've seen a lot of things. So who knows at this point, and I'm sure you have as well.
I've seen drones. There was a working with a company recently that specializes in drone security, and they talked about how in a red team exercise, they put a fake Wi-Fi point on top of a drone and then flew it and dropped it on top of a building.
And then people connected to it as if thinking it was legit. Yeah, I've always thought about doing that as well. Like airport is the other one. Like you just connect to a sort of any Wi-Fi going there. So, what you know, you could easily probably do that. But I mean, that's a topic for another day. So, Mark, I've absolutely enjoyed our discussion today and your insights and your stories. Is there anything specific you'd like to leave our audience with?
No, I think it was probably in that last comment that we made around, again, don't try not to get caught upon the fanciful ways in which you could be breached. Implementing the basics of cyber hygiene will protect you against the majority of the attacks that are out there. Think about cybercrime and think about nation states. They're not always stringing together extraordinarily crazy ways to try and breach you. It will be something simple. So let's not make it easy for them. Let's get there. Let's eliminate those basics.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MercSec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MercSec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.